Chili Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Chelly.
26th day of August 2021, allegedly according to that thing we call a calendar. And this indeed is the show you were looking for. How do I know that? Well, because you indeed found it. Anyway, Thursday should be the second to last broadcast day of the week. But then again, I'm doing this thing on Saturdays late, which is really Sunday early, with Hesher. And I don't know what Metal Masterpiece Theater is going to sound like this week, but... But anyway, we're not there yet. So that's the way it is. Now, on Thursdays, I made an effort to bring on authors of interest. And I don't know. We're going to change things up soon. So you'll have to see what Thursday turns into coming in September. But as it stands, I've had a lot of different authors on all different days of the week, not just Thursdays. So... this tonight will be no exception. However, there will be exceptions. Generally, I have on somebody whose work I've gone through extensively, analyzed, have an idea about how it is I can approach it and all that kind of stuff. Here's the fun part. I am not through this individual's work. I have only glanced at it. Why? I want to... examine it for a couple of different reasons. And full disclosure, the author I have on tonight is a supporter of my show, a supporter of Aaron's show. Okay, but that's not why he's here. Other people, and I'm not going to name names, have been supporters of my show who've tried to come on. They want to come on, and I have pretty much said that either their book or their concept sucks. And I'm sorry, I appreciate your support, but I have no cause to go further into your work. This has not made me some friends in the self-publishing world, I gotta tell you. But then again, I'm more than happy to aggravate people at Simon & Schuster and Skyhorse and everywhere else, because your book sucks. And if you can't even get me to crack it open because of the premise, that's one thing. And then when I do crack it open and find out, you know how right I was, probably three times more right than I thought I was to begin with, I'm not wasting my audience's time. You guys are worthy of a lot more than that. So guess what? A guy is a supporter, but also has passed part of that test because I want to engage with this sort of thing, especially when I see elements of things that are kind of alien to my normal wheelhouse. And I don't mean just it's got to be, you know, strange to me, but it's got to be strange to me and also seem to serve a purpose and to further either the expansion of education or the mind itself, one way or another, because, again, got to be worthy of me asking you, the listener, to make the effort to either buy or go and acquire, or go and look at, and I don't care if their book is free. I'm asking you to make an effort to go and do what? Absorb some information that somebody else thought was worthy of print. And I gotta be honest with you, a lot of times I find, I don't write reviews on Amazon, I don't bother with it, because I would be a guy who just is negative all the time. People waste your time with a lot of books. People waste your time with videos. People waste your time. I don't want to do that. I just don't want to do it, and I'm not going to encourage anybody to do it. So, Sam Idelet, and I think I pronounced that right, but then again, I had to take my lead from Aaron Franz because he had you as a guest first, and how you doing, man?
Doing good. Thanks for the intro. I mean, I'm actually honored that I passed your test because, I mean, I know you don't BS, so I definitely believe you that. You know, you wouldn't just have anybody. And I agree with you, actually. I second your opinion that, especially these days, it's like we're bombarded with media, like 24/7, like as we're sleeping, our phone is going off, like
right.
Something new is to consume. So I second what you just said. I'm pretty much over a lot of media, but I appreciate that you value my book, and at least it piqued your curiosity enough to have me on the show and talk about it. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, it did, and you okay. Let's, before we get into it, I mean, let's, before we get lost in the conversation, give everybody your website and, you know, and tell them the title of the book. I mean, if you want, tell them exactly how they can identify the cover of it, which, by the way, I had a whole bunch of things, you know, set up in my little notes that I usually, my little cheat sheet that I don't have reminding myself. I told them this just before we went to air, so, I mean, I'm not even... not even making this up. I just got booted out of my own chat room. Whatever. I got, like, you know, one computer working. That's the broadcast computer. So here we go. And I know it's being recorded, so good enough. But everything else, I don't know what to tell you guys. Sorry. Anyway, Sam, please give them that information. And then we're going to go through a very interesting dance here, you and I. Funny I say that, right? And it's going to be... It might sound hostile to some people, even. But bear with me. Just stay tuned. Give them the website and the name of the book and, you know, how they can get it, please.
Yeah, so website is called dancingwithmyfate.com. The book is also called Dancing With My Fate, a handbook about life and death. And, you know, please do check out the site. It's also on sale at Amazon, Lulu. It's, right now, it's just a physical copy, so I don't even have an ebook. But, yeah, I mean, there's a little bit more information on the site, but that's how you can get to it. As for me, I mean, I gave a little bit of intro about the book, I guess, in this spot, if that's okay, Chuck.
Yeah, please do, because we're gonna get into some of what I heard during the interview with you and Aaron, because I produced that show, and a few things I read. I mean, I know that you have very solid intentions here, but I don't know. There's something very weird about this situation and why it is you decided to create this book and all that. So, yeah, by all means, give the introduction and let's begin to roll from there. Of course, I have no script, even with my cheat sheet, but this is the way I roll. So, extemporaneously, let's go. Yeah,
I like it.
You go ahead.
So, all right. So the tagline of the book is, if you want the truth, you have to find it for yourself, but I can help you craft your strategy for finding it. And, you know, the onus for this really was my increasing disillusionment or my increasing sense of powerlessness around my ability to enact change. And, you know, I think a lot of your listeners have a similar path as what I have had, and we can talk about that a little bit later. You know, as a truth seeker or as a person, you know, I like to call it just a person that is observant, you know. Mm-hmm. But so not in a condescending way, but I mean, the truth is all around. But you know, you have to really find it for yourself, because, you know, I've found and I've learned some hard lessons. I call it a school of hard knocks, that, you know, any framework, any ideological framework comes with strings attached. Mm-hmm. And can be weaponized, even ones with good intentions, and maybe even especially some of the ones with good intentions. And that's one of the themes of the book. It's kind of the road to hell is paved with good intentions type theme. So anyway, you know, I wrote the book, my version of the truth. You know, but what it's really about is how to find the truth. And my version is really not as important as that journey that I undertook, that I think I've succeeded at, and I'll let the readers of the book decide whether or not that's true. But that's also the point, because then we get to engage in a conversation about it, and then we're united in a common cause, trying to figure out, you know, even just the question, what is the truth? That's a really important question for a community that calls itself, you know, truth seekers, you know, or, you know, 9/11 truth, or a lot of the things that people were involved in, you know, over the years, the truth about the JFK conspiracy. So right. I think it's at this point in the game, I think it's very important to have that conversation about what it is. And like I said, I claim to have my opinion, and that's it. But what I do think I've discovered is a good way of discerning what it is, and grappling with the powers that be, grappling with, you know, sometimes what they call post-truth. I also don't agree with that, but in the introduction, I talk about what life sometimes can feel like a all-encompassing gaslighting operation. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of sums up my view of things and what we're up against in a way. So I'll leave it there, and then we can kind of dive in.
No, fair enough. And look, in any exploration on this sort of level, you have to begin, in my mind, and maybe this is the old man here, right? I mean, because you're younger than I am, I think. By probably, you know, you'd be little brother kind of status to me, maybe, if we got a distance here. How old are you exactly again?
So I'm in my 30s.
You're in your 30s. Okay. Yeah, so I'm 49. All right. So we're either at that, you know, I could have had you as a baby in high school or I'm your older brother kind of deal here, you know, older uncle.
There we go.
Okay. See, but there is a generational context here. And I find that there's always a shift between the generations when it comes to the objective status of what they define as truth to begin with. And we all come from different baselines. And I think it's because we're steeped in, here we go with the odd terms. We're steeped in a particular zeitgeist, which is inescapable. It doesn't necessarily mean that we represent it ever after, but I do think it's a point of interest when you're trying to come up with, okay, what perspective are we dealing with? How does this guy even define a word like truth? And I'm going to step away from your terms for a moment and go to two interesting terms I heard discussed recently, and they aggravated the hell out of me. And that is the concept of being awake, which I have now listened to being tossed around for 20 years. Awake, I'm awake. You're not awake, I'm awake. Okay. And now you have the issue of, well, what is wokeness versus awake? And let me tell you, I objectively see that there is a very small contingent of individuals who are not sleepwalking, no matter what they call themselves, one way or another, because they have internalized this concept of their worldview being the primary metric by which everyone else will now measure reality. And this to me has always been silly. I understand exactly how small my mind is compared to the rest of the collective consciousness. I some people would say, well, that's very reductionist and you're kind of nihilistic, and, you know, is there any point to any of your exploration? And yeah, I've been there already. And honestly, a lot of people that claim to be philosophers, whether it was that lady who ran for president, you know, who kind of stole, what was it? I forget which.
Marianne Williamson?
Yeah, I forget which one of those self-help guru programs she stole from somebody else, basically, to make herself famous. And I'm not saying that she didn't have good ideas or that she didn't generally have the correct lens on things when she said, you know, there is a darkness kind of rising and this is happening. Seems pretty accurate to me, but at the same time, she was a shyster. I mean, she was out there.
George Lucas's wedding or something, didn't she?
What's that? I'm sorry.
I think she like married George Lucas or something. Like I read that about her, so I don't know if that's true.
You know what?
I know she's done like stuff with the stars, and yeah, I mean,
no, absolutely. I wish I cared enough to explore it enough, right? I know that she was kind of in Oprah's universe at one point.
Yeah, Oprah, yeah.
You know, and I know that's the stamp of approval for some people who have a baseline that's all okay and good and fine and dandy and chicken soup for the soul, and what is the latest, you know, a psychodrama that you can play with other people, and how it is that you can become a guru to the masses, and oh, Dr. Phil's a good guy, and I'm almost gonna fall asleep as I'm saying all this. I'm sick and tired of silliness, and I'm not saying she wasn't coming from a good place. I in general can't argue with you know, not all of her wackiness, but I mean, her general stance on things did seem to have some clarity to it, and a whole lot more than, quite frankly, a lot of these people who tell me that they are objectively truth seekers, and then you listen to where their baseline is or is not, they're still well steeped in this idea that they have a team that they belong to. And, you know, you can be tribal all you want, but false tribalism is not going to get you anywhere. So there's another weird aspect to this, and it, again, it's going to sound hostile. And so I'm going to begin throwing questions at you with one of the nastiest ones I got. Okay,
bring it up. Let's do it, Jack.
Let's do it, right? I'll tell you this. I have this very mixed feeling when it comes to individuals who have served in the military. Mm. And you did, right?
I did.
So understand, I'm not trying to be disrespectful to you. I am going to take something apart here. I mean, full disclosure, I loved my father, but he was a guy who basically gave up part of his soul in Vietnam. And he knew it, and he destroyed himself. And I gotta say, it's one of those things that is not easy for me to talk about to this day. There have been other people that I have cared about deeply, that I have watched engage with military conditioning. And I understand the purpose of it, and breaking down people so that they can be built back up. And I get all of the psychology behind it. But ever after, it seems as though there is a very serious difference between individuals in the Western world, anyway, who have served in the military and those who haven't, because there are certain defaults built in here that honestly feels like a serious limitation on individuals who have served to be able to, guess what, think for themselves anymore. Now, I got to tell you, talking to guys who served in World War II, and I did that just for my own research and my own study of history, talking to guys who served in Korea, talking to a lot of guys who served in Vietnam for more personal research and stuff that had to do with the Kennedy assassination and everything else, it has prevailed. It doesn't matter what generation it is. Guys that were in my age group who, you know, got involved at a time when there wasn't a worldwide conflict, you know, some of them coming right out of high school and going to Desert Storm, stuff like that, and then desperately wishing to re-enlist when the war on terror came back around because they still had the same default position that my father had when he signed up going to Vietnam and wanting to fight those terrible, evil people that were the enemy over there for one reason or another. And repeatedly, there's a disillusionment and a justification. And no matter where these guys go ever after, it's very weird. I mean, the only example I can think of that's super, super well known of a guy who served in the military and then definitely did not adhere to the kind of typical control systems is what? Jimi Hendrix. I mean, outside of him, okay? Anybody, and I never met Jimi Hendrix, obviously, but even guys who became musicians, guys who went on to just, you know, live the life of the outlaw biker, guys who went on to go into business, guys who went on to be successful, guys who went on to be walking disasters because they could never get over some of the things that they endured serving at certain periods of time. It just seems as though this limitation is permanently affixed to them where they don't think for themselves. Now, that sounds like I just indicted everybody who has ever put on a uniform. Again, really, it's an American issue because that's where I've had the most exposure to military people is American military people. So it sounds like I've just indicted them all. In a way, I've found that to be consistently true, that they become permanently limited to only accepting what the controllers allow them to select off of the menu. Now, some of them attempt to reach outside of it, but when I dig into it, I mean, there's a guy that I'm supposed to meet with at some point who is now a mushroom farmer, and he's, you know, and I'm not just talking about psilocybin here, although I do find value in that, who is a veteran and has had, you know, military family all the way through, all that stuff. And remember, I also care about my ancestry, and ever since there's been somebody in my family in America, every single generation, we offer up several people to go through the military. And yet, I will tell you this. If somebody I see is of value and a young person who could contribute to society, one of the things that I would never ask them to do is to put on that uniform. And in fact, if they are of value and are simply not, you know, wild spirits out of control in need of structure, which they might be able to get from prison just as easily as they would get from the military, I would never, ever subject anybody I care about to that or suggest that they go through it because of this harsh sort of governing limitation I see upon them. So tell me I'm wrong.
Well, I mean, first of all, your observations, I'll say that, you know, how am I going to phrase this? I mean, let me think about the way to phrase this best. So the fact that there's an army, like, there's an army persona, right? Mm-hmm. And for years after I got out of the army, people would be like, you were in the military. And like, yeah, how did you know? You got the army face, you know, stuff like that. So, I mean, that's real, you know, because I mean consistently, mm-hmm. you know, and that's finally wearing off after like a decade. But, you know, more broadly to your point, I mean, the army, you know, the military admits that they brainwash you during basic. I mean, that's like they proudly claim that. I mean, and if they don't, you know, necessarily officially, you know, they endorse movies like, you know, what's his name, Gomer Pyle, and, you know, Full Metal Jacket. I mean, when I went in basic, you know, the night before basic, we were at a hotel and a bunch of guys were like, we're going to go watch Full Metal Jacket on the first day before basic. And even then, I mean, I was enthusiastic about the military, but even then I was like, really? Like that, you know, that movie's like anti-military, right? Like, but it's not, that's the thing, because it's all kind of part of the mystique and the legend of the military. And I came to realize that. So more broadly to your point, yeah, I mean, I think to your point about, you know, people in the military, I'm proud that I served. Mm-hmm. So I'll put it that way first. Also, I don't think that the military is any better or any worse than, you know, most other fields of employment. You know, I mean, you can get chewed up and spit out in Hollywood. You can get chewed up and spit out in, you know, any industry, you know. So I think the best antidote to having a individual self-worth and in all of that is just growing up in the upper middle class or above, where you have enough money to protect you from being exploited. You know, so that, to your point there, I mean, if you don't have a lot of money, like, really, you don't really have much of an opportunity to develop yourself as like a, not saying that's impossible, but it's difficult because people are going to be trying to exploit you because you don't have a lot of options. You know,
this is a key thing, because as you just, and I'm so glad you answered that the way you did. And I want you to continue to expand upon this, because you know what? Dead on. The deal is this. If there is an industry, whether it is there to crank out soldiers, or it is there to crank out, you know, other people that we can either psychologically or physically run through the meat grinder for profit, yeah. And it doesn't matter if it's entertainment.
Whatever you want to see, yeah.
Or the, right. It doesn't matter. It is exactly the same thing. It's just that why is it that I am profoundly upset by the military? You struck right upon it, which is that, you know who that grabs up? is anybody who doesn't seem to have another opportunity. And they get convinced by the legend, okay? And look, I'm not trying to attack military service people. Don't take it that way. I'm trying to say that I feel as though they are unjustifiably abused by a system that, you know, on the one hand, there is this concept among the rest of the public, the rest of us, of troop worship. But on the other hand, you know what? I don't see guys being taken care of psychologically. I don't care what the VA does. I don't care what these veterans groups do. I see all the time nothing but individuals that fall through the cracks because they sacrificed under the idea that they were there doing it initially, probably for their country or whatever. And yes, I've also heard many, many times about how it really comes down on to what's in front of your face. And you got to take care of the people that are there with you. And you have your brothers in arms. And I get all that too, because guess what? You don't have to be in the military to experience that. You can do that on a street level when you're just all poor and trying to figure out a way to survive in a harsh situation. This is what happens. So the fact that a lot of times it's street kids and people that have no other opportunities that are, you know, the first recruited and the first sent into most hostile situations and all that good stuff is actually fully logical.
It reminds me of John Bolton said in his autobiography, he was like, I didn't want to go to Vietnam because I didn't want to die in a rice paddy in Nowheresville or something. I mean, it's a somewhat like that. That made me laugh because, I mean, that's a perfect example of what you just said, because he, as a young person at Yale, had a historical contextualization of what was going on and was like, oh, hell no. You know,
right?
Which makes sense. Like, to be completely honest, I mean, I think he's an asshole for saying that, considering his, you know, record of what he's been responsible for. But, you know, at the same time, you know, as an individual, I understand his desire for self-protection.
Well, for preservation. Who knows about protection? And with that in mind, look,
it effaces the individual in you. I agree. Right. I mean, it's designed. I mean, when I was in the I was in the infantry, Chuck. So I mean, I was in the realest of the real, I guess you could say. And I mean, there was an ongoing thing. Not ironically, you know, my NCOs would regularly, you know, if anyone did anything that was like unique or, you know, was not completely conformist, there was like a lashback on them, and they'd be like, oh, are you being an individual? As if that was like the biggest insult.
Right. Now,
I was like, I would always get a kick out of that because I'm like, oh man, like I don't want to be caught being an individual.
Right. No, fair enough, because that would be a crime. And meanwhile, look, we do have live interaction. So in the chat room, something is being said here, and I want to address it in this context right now. Most other organizations don't send you abroad to terrorize people in other nations like the military does. Now, pause for a second, Sam, because you're going to hear something weird considering what I just said to you. Yes and no, Face Shifter, and I'll tell you why I say yes and no. I get the idea, that sentiment, and believe me, I feel that in my gut, where there are individuals that have stated one way or another that, in truth, war and the business of the military and all this comes down to nothing more than a justification for murder and domination, and that's that. That is all it is, and it certainly is a racket, and it certainly is a business model, and it certainly is not something where, you know, everybody is covered with bloodlust at all times. Some people just want to keep their jobs making airplane parts. I get it. But at the end of the day, you know what? When you think about the corporate global system, there are people without guns that wind up going to foreign lands to dominate, terrorize, and murder people. And the thing is that they don't actually ever have to pull triggers, and they do it all the time, too. So I would say that the military is not the only organization that does that. And you can look at the diplomatic corps and the way they deal with things, and you can find that they make decisions without a problem that, you know, end up with people having to sort things out later. When I look at what's going on current event-wise, and Afghanistan, which I don't want to discuss with you, Sam. I just want to tell you that now.
Good. Thanks.
The thing is, that disaster, after 20 years, shows you exactly how much care and effort goes into caring about what happens to, oh, I don't know, people. Forget about, you know, oh, it's Afghans, and it's, oh, these are people that are ISIS-K, and this is the Taliban, and you know what? If there was a bit more care about what actually happened to, I don't know, other human beings in general, you wouldn't see events like you're seeing right now. It's not part of the equation. And blood is money in the corporate world. Blood is money when it comes to financial manipulations and the domination of natural resources and, you know, turning around and causing an entire population to be responsible for debt they never signed up for because somebody cut a deal with King whoever. This is just, I don't know, all of human history. This is the way this goes, and you don't always need to point a gun at a population to cause massive bloodshed. So, you know, I get that the military is the most obvious, and it is easy to get to it. But, man, it's, you know, and when you take a look at the esoteric aspect of it, you know, we can go into a whole other direction. How, you know, there are individuals that are just simply marked for slaughter, and sometimes you can mark them with different grades and everything else. And we can go into that if you want, but I don't want to go there with Sam because I'm trying to get at a particular portion of his psychology that I'm wondering if it is part of the formula for this search for truth and this ability to form a strategy. Because one thing is, Sam, going back to your premise, if you imagine that part of your training regarding strategy must, in my mind, have been partially based on your experience as somebody engaged in the military, I think it's fair to explore this. If you don't think so.
No, I agree. Okay. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. Like, and, you know, the idea of a strategy is inherently one based on conflict, because if you have harmony, then, you know, a strategy is something that kind of requires deceit, you know, or at least concealment of your true intentions in order to obtain the result of, you know, your desired outcome of your strategy. Mm-hmm. Well, so yeah, Sun, I mean, there's Sun inherently Tzu, in there an yeah. adversarial.
From Sun Tzu to MacArthur, you're not going to find any strategy that does not require deception on some level or other. It's just impossible.
Sun Tzu, I mean, any master strategist.
Mm-hmm. No, that's what I'm saying. It doesn't matter. Anybody who had even remote success as a military operator cannot deny that they had to, deceive the enemy at some point. You know, it's one of the easier ways as opposed to just simply going and you know, blunt force. You know, not everybody can be Genghis Khan. And even then, I think legend outstretches the fact that there must have been some level of deceit. They hid their numbers pretty well. I mean, the truth is that even when you go into like Attila the Hun, you find out you don't even know where these people even came from. You know, it's like very weird when you try and study some of the ancient, you know, military masters. You find that deception is a guarantee. And World War II is an interesting menagerie of deceptions when you study that. And that's the easiest thing to look at because there's enough distance there and most of the people that participated in it are gone. So you can do that now. and take a look at some of the records and the way they were preserved, and we have these wonderful things called films. I mean, it helps. But inexorably, there is no separation in my mind between how it is you would formulate a strategy and the idea that it would have to be at least influenced by your military experience. So this is why I'm breaking this down with you a bit and trying to get at this, because I'm wondering how much of it is about uniformity. And if indeed that works to inspire you to eventually break out of that, to stop being that guy, because as you said, for some years afterwards, and believe me, I'm going to talk a lot less as we get further into this, okay? But when you take a look at it, for a couple of years there, it was probably brutally obvious you had been in the Army. And look, when it comes to Marines, they're even less individuals than the Army guys are, okay? And Navy guys are maybe, somewhere in that gradient. I mean, Air Force guys are a little bit different. Nowadays, of course, you send National Guard and everything everywhere, seems like. So, I mean, really, Air Force guys are the only ones who I've ever seen that kind of didn't always fall right in line for a couple of years after they got out. Some of them got right out and said, you know what, I'm going to try and be an individual now. But for years afterwards, most people will carry on with this. I mean, and I saw guys that I met like in the 80s who had served in, you know, in the 60s, who still, it was like they walk into a room, you knew this guy was in the military. You just knew it. And they carry it on for a long, long time. And like you said, you get broken down and they do brainwash you directly. So you got to admit, at some point, you probably lost sight of your individuality in order to function.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, so Chuck, I mean, I think what you're getting at is, you know, well, two things. One, you're kind of questioning, can I trust you? Are you part of the machine? And I think that's a fair question. I mean, I'm willing to put myself and stand up and be vulnerable. I mean, I'm already on the show.
Mm-hmm.
But then the second question is, you know, how could you survive, you know? And I think that's a fair question too. And I mean, I think it's a fair question because, like, to your point, I mean, it's really, really hard to survive, man. And I mean, I don't know very many people that did. You know, to be honest, I had a couple of advantages. You know, one, you know, I'll tell you exactly how I survived, Chuck. And I mean, this is getting a little bit personal, but I think why not? Let's do it, right? You're asking and I'm here.
Okay.
So the first thing is I want to clarify that, you know, I don't agree with you that everyone that has ever served in the military, is inherently brainwashed. I don't know if that's what you're saying. I do think there's a way out on the other side. I think I can clear that up as I keep explaining.
Okay.
For one thing, I agree with Nietzsche when he says what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. I do believe that.
Oh yeah.
Because adversity is also a great teacher. And everything that comes into your life, if you can learn from it, then you grow stronger. You grow stronger. And the, you know, then that helps you with your strategy. So I do believe that that helped me. And what I mean by that is, yes, you know, the military broke me down, but it also gave me an understanding that, you know, I'm not afraid, because once you face certain demons and you come out the other side, you know, if I can take the hazing from, you know, a bunch of staff sergeants that had been deployed 6 times and, you know, had extreme PTSD in the 82nd Airborne, then I sure as hell can survive most things, you know? So I'm not so afraid as I used to be. And that's a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. The other part of it is, you know, there's a sense of beauty in facing that level of the extreme in human nature, because, you know, I see the world in a completely different way. You know, I went and I saw a war zone, and, you know, I also saw the the Eye of Sauron, I guess you could call it, of like the machine. You know, I saw the inner workings of the machine grinder. You know, I saw, you know, most people in America see the, they either are looking at it through the screen of Hollywood, and that's how they get their reality, or they're looking at it through their corporate job, or, you know, maybe their blue collar job, or whatever the case may be. But every single one of those things are bubbles. I mean, that's fueled by a fantasy of, you know, Hollywood that's not real, or it's fueled by, you know, the relative affluence of, you know, at least up until more recently, of American society, where even a blue-collared person, up, you know, decreasingly so, Chuck, as I'm sure most people on this show are aware, but, you know, there is a level of affluence that protects American psyche from the harshness of the world, you know, and that's something that's very apparent when you go to a place like Iraq, you know, and you see, you know, I saw with my own eyes, you know, people, you know, living in horrible conditions. And then, you know, around that, there's a oil rig that has like huge walls, and there's a bunch of, you know, contractor guards with, you know, big AK-47s and stuff all around it so that no one can get inside, and, you know, trucks go in and out all day and all night. What are they, where are they giving, where are they shipping that oil? You know, you gotta put the pieces together to kind of figure that out. But, you know, to see that, to see the inner machine grinding away, I mean, this is the fabric that puts that fantasy of America, that you know, that creates it. This is the raw materials that creates everyday life for Americans. You know, at least most Americans, because I want to acknowledge that, like, there's a whole millions of people for whom they do not participate in the fantasy one bit, you know, because they're just trying to struggle to survive, you know. But for the people in the bubble of, you know, American exceptionalism, in the bubble of, you know, American dominance. And so, yeah, I mean, I see that as a gift.
Right.
I'll be honest with you, though, Chuck, like, that took a long time. Part of that strategy is, you know, kind of revealed in the book of how I got to figure that out. And yeah, I went through a lot of pain, man. it wasn't very much fun. And, you know, especially when I was in. But looking back, right, would I do it again? Probably not. But I mean, if I had to do it again, yeah, you know, I'd be all right.
I find this interesting. And this was one of the key points that I actually wanted to get to with you. Because I heard you sort of describe that, you know, you didn't come from a bad place. It's not like you were in the worst of conditions growing up, this kind of thing. And so you might have still been attached to this, you know, American exceptionalist fantasy, which to me is purely, purely ridiculous. And I'll tell you why. It's not because I'm coming from some, you know, left-wing academic position here. It's because life taught me way before I could have ever, even though, you know, visually I could never sign up for the military. Although I likely would have been one of those guys who was taken in. Because of where I came from. The bottom line is, there is a whole section of America that I have dubbed Invisible America anyway. And I lived in Invisible America, where this idea that, you know, you could do anything, you could be anything, that was not part of me. That was not part of my reality. That was far from, you know, anything that would have made sense to me. The, you know, people talk today about, oh, well, the cops were our friends at one point. I never had that impression. I never had that impression on any level.
Past is always way better for some, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just saying, you know, like these people, they go, you know, when we grew up, it was nice like this and like that. And I'm like, oh, well, you didn't grow up with me, did you? No, you didn't. So you didn't have that default position of, you know, this could be a good place. I mean, they told us that kind of stuff. But, I mean, it was laughable. You know, to me at the age of seven, it was laughable. Because it was like, yeah, okay, this is the land of opportunity. How come I'm watching good people just get crushed by everything? And how is it that, you know, we have this great land of opportunity and you watch people destroy themselves intentionally because it's just not altogether survivable if you're part of what's not supposed to be seen. And there is a whole world that goes on. And people talk about rural America and, oh, well, you know, in certain places where they didn't even have running water. No, no, no. You didn't even need that. You could be right there amidst the people that were supposedly privileged, and you were still a shadow, a ghost. And that is the fate of a great many people that, believe it or not, still count among those numbers of individuals that you call Americans. They're still there. They're still bleeding. They're still getting sick right along with you. They're still suffering whatever goes on when the economic conditions turn and change and the opportunities are sometimes less for people right out of the gate. And it doesn't matter what the color of their skin is or their religion is. It's just you were born into the invisible part of America. That's that. Here you will stay. And, yeah. You know, there is something to that as well. Now, I got to be honest with you. I'm not complaining about it like, poor me. I'm telling you that what that taught me was that there are layers to all of this. And when you take a look at you see, again, this is going to get right back around to where you started. What is objective truth to somebody who is in that position versus somebody who says, you know what, I think it's a good idea. I mean, clearly, you were not drafted into the military. Because that was not part of what went on during, you know, your generation's opportunity to do so. Draft would have been different than volunteering. And there were certain things that went on there, and you didn't have the Vietnam issue, which again, you know, ended when I was a small child. It was a different era entirely, but at the same time, all of these rules still apply, and even as we speak, I guarantee you there are individuals that just are not participating in everything that people think of as, you know, part of the American experience. Not everybody gets to participate, and not everybody even gets to be deluded by the idea that, don't worry, there is always upward mobility. It's just not there. For some people, it just does not exist. And yeah. You know what? In some ways, that actually shapes a finer and better character than individuals who maybe had those opportunities. And then when you go beyond that, there's the John Boltons and the other classes, right? There is definitely a class and really a caste system here, whether it is declared or not. It exists, and there are individuals that will never, ever even have to consider, unless they want to add it to their resume and go into officer school and whatever else, they'll never even have to consider the ideas that you had to consider going in. I mean, yes, allegedly that they have to go through the same basic training as you and everything else, but you know you're not looking at the same formulated character that right. Somebody like you would wind up earning by going through that experience. So there is a different formative experience here for you than there would be the kid who's got no other opportunity and just needs a job. And also the rich kid who thinks that military service might be good for his political career later. There is a whole other experience there. So right away, there's immediately three different trajectories. And two of which you didn't have the opportunity to engage with, right? Because, again, you came from kind of a typical sort of run-of-the-mill situation. At least that's the way you described it, I thought, on Aaron's show. But there's another layer to that even, where there are people that insist, well, no, we weren't poor, but we weren't rich. And if you take a look at where they were at economically, in a lot of cases, they don't even recognize what background they really came from. Very funny, where I used to be in communities where everybody was actually, you know, poverty line. And there were individuals that somehow thought there was a hierarchy in that. I always found that funny. And then even among the middle class, like I said, we're middle class, they're upper middle class. You know, everybody keeps subdividing and creating this, we're not part of this community because, well, I'm above them because I actually, my family's a little better off. How often have I heard that? And in reality, when you study the circumstances, it's almost always the warped concept of where people really stand. Now, you get knocked down for real. You get into being engaged in violence, whether it's through the military or it's on the street or wherever else. And it is not something that you know, provoked for fun. Okay, you get into these sort of circumstances, your formative issues, your strategic brain gets wired in a whole different way from the individuals who are, you know, well, I think we should just send 10,000 troops in, and they can flippantly say that. And, you know, and things, you have an entirely different brain. It's almost like you're a different species.
Yeah, I mean, Chuck, I feel like to what you just said, I mean, it's that repetition, right? Because, so I'll tell you a little bit about myself here, too.
Sure.
So I grew up, you know, I would actually say upper middle class. And the reason I say upper is because, you know, there's a lot of people that say like, okay, you know, I'm middle class, but actually, you know, they don't have, you know, the upward mobility to enter the upper reaches of society. Like you said, the John Boltons, you know, with me, you know, I grew up in an area where there's a lot of education, Northern Virginia. Dad was a military officer. I had some connections. If I had wanted to and done really well in school, I could have gone to UVA. I could have done the, you know, CIA or something, you know, State Department or whatever. A lot of my friends did do that. Or if I did the military, I could have gone officer and done this. I could have done that, right? Mm-hmm. The reason I did not was because I was a total social misfit and outcast that, you know, had real hard time even just, you know, being part of the social scene of high school.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for me, and I escaped into music, right? So I was a musician, as we talked about a little bit the last show.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of my saving thing. So, but, you know, at the same time, you know, so I went to Berklee College of Music for a little bit, you know, which is kind of cool. But then I ended up with a bunch of debt and, you know, my parents could have paid it off, you know, again, and they could have done that and bailed me out. But I was like, no, I'm going to do this. So I joined the army and joined the infantry because I saw this Metallica video of like guys with guns. And, you know, I thought that was cool. So I did it. And also my dad being an officer, you know, talking about how wonderful, you know, the military is.
Quick question. You don't mean to say you watched the one video and thought, I mean, was it the one video?
No, literally I walked into the recruiter and they were like, you can do something with computers. Or you can go infantry, man. You'll be a ranger. This is cool. Look at these guys. They're riding around the desert having a blast. And I was like, wow, they are having a blast. I'm going to do that too.
Okay, so
that's what happened.
No, let's go for context because you mentioned a Metallica video and I'm like, the first one that came to my mind was...
No, not an actual Metallica video. Metallica, the DOD paid Metallica to use their music.
Right, okay. I wanted to clarify that because here's the thing. You come into this at a time when it was like, the new military rocks, you know?
No, exactly right.
Okay, I know I'm being sarcastic here, but real thing, go look back at the old videos for recruitment.
And it worked. I mean, yeah. It worked for me. I was like, I Disappear. The song was I Disappear.
Mm.
And I remember being like, ah, these guys are rangers and they just disappear in the woods and I can be like that. You know, I didn't think about the fact that they've been in the woods for like 2 weeks and, you know, taking a dump in a swamp for 2 weeks.
Oh, and guaranteed you were already preset with all kinds of movie images and things where you'd seen, you know, Rambo always wins because he was a Green Beret. And now we've got, you know, it's okay. I just wanted to be fair about that.
So
go ahead.
Let me just finish what I was going to say, though, real
please.
Quick. So the point I was trying to make was you mentioned John Bolton and like these upper middle class and above and the people that, you know, kind of the haves versus the have-nots. And this is what I wanted to say about that.
Mm-hmm.
There are people in that position that join the military. They almost completely become officers, and you know they usually have some kind of political aspiration above that, or you know other things, or they'll write an autobiography about how they spent a week in Afghanistan and it was so crazy, you know. Mm-hmm. But the point is, even if they do experience a firefight or some kind of hardship, it's in and out. They go in, they do something, they come back out. You know, I remember the senior, you know, officers had, you know, I found a Martin guitar just like left behind in one of the officers' barracks when they left. So, I mean, meanwhile, like my enlisted people, like we had people living in a cave, and that's like, you know, pretty regular. Like we were at, you know, living on the ground for a year, you know, we got a cot. It was like a good night. Now, that's not to say I'm not trying to compare, you know, it was so bad, because when we would go to the main post and stuff, you know, there was KFC, there was some good stuff. You know, I'm not going to lie, it wasn't all like, it wasn't like anything like what people experienced in Vietnam and stuff like that. But at the same time, like you said, that psychological repetitiveness of it breaks you down. You do it again and again. And it's the same thing with basic. Okay, you can do it for a week and come out and retain your individuality. You do it for a whole year every single day, and then, you know, even back in your own unit back home, you're just mowing the grass all day long, getting yelled at, scrubbing toilets, doing training, getting treated like crap day in and day out, all day, every day for 5 years. You know, that's how long my enlistment was, 4.5 years. Uh-huh. It gets a little better when you make a little bit of rank, but then you're expected to do it to the other guy, you know?
Right.
So that's the thing. And I think that's what gave me a sense of solidarity with people like, you know, janitorial staff or custodial staff. Or, and I'm not saying I have any idea what they go through. All I'm saying is I know what it feels like to have to wake up every morning and do something shitty every day for the foreseeable future of your life, and how fucking terrible that is. Sorry for cursing. I don't know if we can curse on this show.
Well, normally I ask people not to, but don't worry about it. We're fine.
Thank you. I won't do it again. But anyway, I think you get my point. Like,
no, I do. I do.
That's the conditioning. That's what it is.
Yeah.
That's how the Boltons and you know the Petraeuses of the world can you know revel in their own glory. You know, while you know, and Petraeus, maybe he did see some stuff, but like you know, then he got to go back and you know hang out and do all that cool stuff, and I had to scrub the toilets.
Yeah, and dig holes. And whatnot. I mean, because look, that was the striking thing that I think everybody misses when they start talking about, you know, and now we have a distance, you know, between Vietnam and now. But I mean, I try and paint this picture sometimes where it's like, look, my father was like a criminal kid, okay, in New Jersey, and signed up thinking that, you know, I'm going to go fight communists, really, seriously. And thought that was a good idea, and in a very short time, because he was taken in 1968. Yeah, that was right after the Tet Offensive, and there was some tough times over there. And then, hey, you're in the jungle for a year. you know, it's a different experience from these guys who show up and, well, I talked to the troops that were there. Yeah, okay. It's a whole other experience. And that's, but the thing is, it applies across the board.
Yeah, it's not just the military. It's the custodial staff at the building you work in, and you're the, you know, creative director of artistic, you know, whatever. And, you know, not to denigrate people, you know, I mean, people work hard, and I didn't say that to be disrespectful, but
no, I get
there's something said about, you know, you don't hate your job, you know?
No.
I mean, you have options if you have a job like that. Whereas if you're a custodial staff, you know, or if you're a security person, or if you're a a cafeteria person, you know, food preparation, you know, all of these things are just the grind. You do the same thing over and over again. The military,
right.
Sex workers, strippers. I mean, that's the epitome of it. And that's what keeps society going. That's what keeps that fantasy engine running. Day in and day out, and they're, like you said, invisible.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is that there is something to be said about that, and here's the bottom line on it is that quite frankly, there's way more of those people that are being ground up and really the oil for the machine than there are people at the switch. Sam Idolette is with me, and we've gone kind of personal in the first hour, but in the next, I'm going to delve into this book more directly, because now we've gotten some of the foundational principles. Where is this guy coming from? And I know it's kind of an odd interview that I'm doing here, but truth is, I never do standard interviews anyway, so you guys know that if you're regular listeners, and if not, welcome to the show. Anyways, we'll be back after this on The Ocelli Effect. Sam Idolette and his book, In Focus, on this particular Thursday. Stick around.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold. Silver. The stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Revelation through conversation.
Do you like history? Real history that you were never taught in schools?
Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia.
By author Mike Swanson, with new documentation never seen before that'll open your eyes to events that led up to this.
Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia, 1945 through 1961.
Get your copy today at Amazon.com.
Why? The Vietnam War.
By author Mike Swanson.
In Denial. Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. By Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to larry-hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at amazon.com in digital or physical form.
Socialize. Ocelli.com.
Learn from our relatively recent history, my brother. That's where I'm coming from. I say all powerful to people.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck Ocelli.
Second hour of the Ocelli Effect begins now at Ocelli.com. But, of course, you're maybe listening to this sometime, someplace else. And in the show notes tonight, I will give you the link to go and look at the website for my guest, Sam Idolet, who I have kind of challenged a little bit and had a pretty frank conversation with about the military experience, which I do not share with him. Look, I've had a lot to say about military stuff, military people, and at the end of the day, I respect and love everybody as much as I'm allowed. But it's a funny thing when during the break, Sam kind of said, what I served in the infantry. I'm not going to be made nervous by a cranky Italian guy asking me questions, which I found hilarious. And I know I'm paraphrasing you, but still, that's about the way it sounded. Great. I'm the cranky Italian guy. I like that. That's hilarious. Also Irish, but, don't tell anybody. Anyways, Sam, I want to get more into the real heart of this. This idea that you can provide somebody with a strategy to go and search for truth on their own, which... By the way, I really appreciate the idea of, look, I'm not your guru, but I'm going to give you a methodology. Believe it or not, that's generally where I'm at with what I do with this show and with almost everything I try and do at this point in my life is, you know what? I'm not going to tell you I have all the answers, but let's clear away some of the crap. And let's get at, some of the things that maybe are not being provided to you elsewhere. Because otherwise, why am I here doing this? And almost sounds like you and I have the same intent in mind here. So I want to get into that. And before we do, because I know I'll forget and run right the hell out of time. Again, give them your website address, please. The title of the book. And then I'm going to shut up for a little bit and let you explain a little bit about this strategy that you're offering in this book for other people to do their own searches. Because I like that. I always like that, where it's like, listen, don't even take exactly my point of view or what I've learned necessarily at face value. Go look yourself and see if this is not reality, and by the way, report back to me and tell me I'm wrong if I'm wrong. I mean, that's how I stand anyway. It sounds like you're very similar. So again, website, book name, and then let's let me shut up and let you explain what is really in there, what the price of admission is really all about with this piece of work that you put out.
Sure. Yeah. So Sam Idolet, book is Dancing with My Fate. Website is dancingwithmyfate.com. You can order it on the website. You can order it on Amazon, Lulu. Right now, only hard copy. Also, feel free to email me. Emails on the website as well. So, yeah. And now, getting into it a little bit. So, Dancing with My Fate, the strategy itself, what it started with is this intuition, right? This intuition that I've always felt that, something is off, and I don't know what it is, but something is wrong with the narratives that I've been provided for most of my life, from authority, from objective knowledge, the idea of truth, at least mainstream truth, whatever you want to call it. And, obviously... there were some movies that were inspirational to me, like The Matrix was like, oh man, I love this movie. But one of my favorite philosophers once said, The Matrix is the movie that The Matrix would make about The Matrix. I always like that, because I find that to be true now.
Well, two things real quick here. And I want you to add this into what you're about to explain. First of all, when it comes to the Matrix, just my quick commentary and the thing that everybody like gets annoyed with is I go, yeah, the fun part about the Matrix is nobody actually left the Matrix.
Right. Exactly.
Which, it, despite, oh, they went to Zion. And no, they didn't. They just got to go into controlled opposition, if you understand what you're looking at. But okay. Anyway, I don't want to have a philosophical argument about that. But one thing that has been missing from this discussion so far, which almost inevitably comes up when you're talking about philosophy and truth and what the reality is, curious, you haven't mentioned religiosity at a point here. So, I mean, I'm a little curious if that system of hierarchical, theoretical,
So I have no, I have no sacred cows, Chuck. So I actually, so what I do is, because I feel that something is off, right? So that's my starting point, right? That's my hypothesis. The hypothesis is that there is something off, right? So I do, the one thing that I do, I'll tell you what the methodology is, right? But I do embrace this idea of reason, right? Hmm. So beyond that, there's nothing on the table. So religion, science, anything, authority, democracy, government, I have no sacred cows. That's okay. That's my starting point, right? So from there,
mm-hmm.
I take five questions. So this, people might be familiar with the five W's. They're it's part of an Aristotle's ethics, his book that he wrote on ethics. But it's basically, you know, the five W's are: who, where are we, who are we, what is reality, why is reality happening, when are we in time, mm-hmm. right? So this is like the most basic place in my mind that you can start from, a complete blank slate. So anyone, you know, maybe someone that is like, I don't believe in reason, pure spirituality only, you know, they might not be able to get behind me on this. But, you know, the vast majority of people, at least in the Western world, would be with me so far on this, right? So from there, I use Occam's razor. Occam's razor is the next thing. If it's the most simple thing, if it's the exact same prediction, the simpler one is better, right? Mm-hmm. So those are my only two things that I use. Those are my two tools. And from there, I claim, and I believe this to be true, that with those two tools, this book, this upends Einstein's theory of relativity. So that's a little hook for you, right?
That's a tall order, but yeah.
That's a big claim, right? That's a big claim. It upends Einstein's theory of relativity. And more, you know, realistically, it crafts a strategy that's purely based on experiential evidence that is my own, but I believe can serve as an example for how others can craft their own strategy and their own theory for living, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little bit of a ironic twist, because I don't actually think that reason is up to the task. I'll give that part of the book away.
That's an interesting qualifier. Reason is not necessarily up to the task, because I've always had respect, mind you, for the Socratic method. But the problem and the fallacy built into that is that you're dealing with reasonable people to begin with.
Common sense isn't all that common.
There you go, and there's the problem. So, how do you boil that back down? That's a big question, isn't it?
It is, and I think that's one of the biggest questions that this book seeks to answer. Which is, you know, everything seems to have baked into it the opposite of itself. You know, this idea of objective irony. You know, so, you know, it's like the cartoon where, like, you know, Elmer Fudd's trying to get, you know, Bugs Bunny, or, you know, there's so many, like, Tom and Jerry, or there's so many examples where, like, you're trying to get something and you're trying to achieve the object of your desire, whether it be knowledge, truth, the truth with a capital T, power, dominance, hegemony, godhood, all of these things.
Well, but, see, and therein lies a problem. Because, okay, and I need to ask this at this point in time, and I'm sorry to interrupt again, but here is something that I personally struggle with, so I'm going to ask you to help me. All right? The intellectual judo that takes place with the truth, capital T, where, look, I can get a room full of people to agree to something that is absolutely ludicrous without too much effort, as long as I know a little bit about the room of people that I'm dealing with, okay? It's not hard to do. And I'll tell you something. When I watch people, bluntly, you have evidence in front of you that, look, how do you not just accept that this is part of what's going on? This is obviously something that occurred over a period of time. You can't possibly blame the individual that is being blamed for a circumstance, this kind of thing. And what do? They turn around and come up with a justification to return to their initial position, as opposed to examining the new data and adjusting their previously held position. So I think of this as intellectual judo, and no matter what you do, there's nothing you can do with this sometimes. Why do I bring this up? Gonna hit a hot button political thing with you, which I shouldn't do, but I'm gonna do it anyway.
You're on real hardballs, Chuck.
Well, but here's the problem, right? You say to somebody, and I had this problem all the way going back to 2015 with people that said, you know, like they're gonna get on the Trump train. People that I thought were thinking for themselves, and people that were very much in the anti-elitist camp. It's like, you know, rich people are screwing everything up and they're screwing all of us. But this rich guy, I trust. And I'm going, okay, what new piece of information here tells you that a guy whose name has become synonymous with, you know, the upper class, richer people is going to suddenly look out for you when you have spent a good chunk of your life screaming that anybody who is in that position is clearly the enemy of anybody who isn't in that position? How do you come to that conclusion from that starting position, right? And they come up, well, he's not part of the inside. And then they go through a bit of a dance, and I'm telling you, it's intellectual judo that causes them to try and use the weight of what you're saying in favor of their position.
Yeah.
And they go, well, no, that's exactly why. You see, a rich guy like this can't be bought off. Well,
Chuck, I don't want to punch down, so I'll give a better example, okay?
Please do.
Ready? So I was reading recently, I was rereading some old stuff, and there was an article about the – you remember Jeremiah Wright, the reverend that he made some speeches back in the – when Obama was running in 2008?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Okay.
All of this. So one of the things he said in one of his – one of his sermons was something to the effect of, oh, they're going to go to Iraq, and if they don't find any WMDs, they're going to be like the LAPD and plant some, you know, so what I found interesting about that, though, was Dick Cheney watched those sermons and was interviewed shortly after. Mm-hmm. And he said that he was stunned by Wright's words. Mm-hmm. And I just find that so hilarious, you know, to your point about intellectual judo, like disturbing and hilarious, because I think it's important to say disturbing, because Dick Cheney is stunned that governments lie about the thing that he lied about or that he helped lie about. His only way that he could be morally redeemable is if he didn't know that the intelligence reports were not accurate. But wouldn't he then not be stunned that someone was, you know, advocating that? No, but he was stunned. So that goes to show. I mean, he doesn't believe in universal truth. He doesn't believe in you know, objective moral values of, you know, he doesn't believe any of that stuff, you know, or maybe he does, but he's just got intellectual judo to the point where, you know, he believes in something that is just inherently contradictory, and is just, maybe he was genuinely stunned.
Okay, superior example to what I offered. Thank you. And I'll tell you why it's superior, because here there's still an open question there. Because you're saying, okay, isn't it disturbing and also amazing this guy would say, well, I'm surprised government would lie. Here's the funny part. There's a whole bunch of parts of Wright's statement there that could be stunning to him. You know, the idea that the LAPD might plant evidence.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't keep a straight face, dude.
It's LA.
You know, and the idea that police might, I mean, see, here's the thing. Which part of it is stunning to him? The idea that police might plant evidence, the idea that the government might lie, the idea that the LAPD might plant evidence. Which part of it? And the fact is, they tried to convince everybody that they had absolute proof before even going in, and nevertheless, I will stand by the statement that that was the destruction of a sovereign nation under false pretense, period. Full stop. Okay? Whatever you say about Hussein, whatever you say about Iraq, I find it wholly unjustifiable from any of the premises that I would understand being willing to send young men into harm's way. I stand by that when it comes to Iraq, unequivocally. But at the same time, that is frightening. Exactly what I wish somebody would have followed up on that with Cheney and really said precisely which part of that is so stunning. Because, you know, explain this to me. And the idea that, you know, there might be you know, operations that take place where the U.S. could do things, you know, after the fact to try and make us...
More generally, Chuck, I mean, a fact that an African-American preacher who, you know, has a huge congregation of mostly African-American people in Chicago could possibly be distrustful of the United States government.
The next level of a good point.
You know, like, I'm stunned that this could even exist. I've never seen something like this before, which is probably true. He has probably never seen something like that.
Well, see, now, and there is the objective reality, is that in some way, you know, after you get over the fact that this is, you know, abjectly idiotic to even think that that's a ludicrous statement. You might disagree with it, but to say that there's no foundation in reality for what Jeremiah Wright said is wholly ignorant. But the idea that he might think that that's the reality, it's possible he's telling the truth, that is actually stunning to him. I'm not even claiming that he's lying in this instance, which I know it's Dick Cheney, so that's hard to swallow, but...
I mean, if you read the private notes of Donald Rumsfeld, they got released, mm-hmm. and he writes in the margins, at one point they talk about the Iraqi prisoners who are in, you know, Abu Ghraib, and they're being forced to stand for hours, you know, without rest and all of this. And he says, I stand for eight hours a day in dress shoes. I don't see the point. Mm-hmm. I mean, he wrote that to himself as a note.
Yeah.
I mean, so he believes that. I mean, to him, he is the same as the person being tortured, and that he can withstand it. I mean, he wrote that note to himself.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is stunning to me that you could equate these things. You know, it's sort of like, well, I've had to walk so many miles to go somewhere. Yeah, but you weren't, you know, in a chain gang while you did it. And you didn't have guns pointed at you while you did it. And for the record, I mean, I had Janis Karpinski on this show to talk about the prison situation. And wow. You know, a whole lot of people that seem to be disconnected from a situation running it, but that could go into a whole other direction. Meanwhile, the intellectual judo that takes place, though, is, I don't know, it's so strange. Is it connected only to this, you know, they're in their bubble so they can't see outside of it? I mean, the bubble is clearly more opaque than it is transparent. I mean, is that just all there is to it? I mean, am I just having a hard time accepting that? I mean, what are your thoughts?
I think it does come down to what you were saying. Actually, the comment that you made when we were on the break, you know, one of the things you said was, you know, it's hard to find people that, you know, aren't just interested in reinforcing, you know, their own. And I think that can be summarized as, you know, some people actually even have a hard time understanding how they were victimized, which is really tragic, right. You know. But most people, I think, or a lot of people can understand the ways that they were victimized. But it's very rare and hard to find someone that can understand the ways that they are victimizing other people, or can at least listen and consider that they might be victimizing other people, you know, even if they don't agree with it, which obviously, you know, you don't have to agree with every single thing that anybody says. But like, take the Reverend Wright example. I mean, he's speaking and saying that, you know, I've been harmed, you know, we've been harmed as a community, and I'm not okay with that. And Cheney is saying that's, you know, I'm stunned that you would even dare to say something like that, or, you know, so many other examples. So to me, that's really the crux of it.
Yeah, you see, know? But okay, and I hate to belabor this point, but I mean, is it a simple lack of empathy, or is it just what I'm starting to think of as the blind sides that people are accustomed to? I mean, is it only the personal experience that they can relate to? I don't know, because I see this as a very strange thing, especially when there are individuals, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to go back to the Trump example for a second, people that know they're looking at somebody who couldn't possibly have experienced what they experienced in their life, and somehow, because some of the words seem similar or in opposition to them, either way, I guess, it works the same way, where, look, Dick Cheney sees Jeremiah Wright as speaking from a position that makes no sense because he takes no account of the different perspective that could be offered by somebody other than himself. I mean, is it just arrogance? Is it a lack of empathy? What do you think that is? Because,
I mean, so I know you're into philosophy, and I mean, Hegel's theory of like the dialectic and the master-slave dialectic. Yeah. And one of the things that really was a powerful piece for me was Georges Bataille. He's a French philosopher, and he said that actually the Hegel's got it wrong, because the master actually, you know, ends up as a slave, mm-hmm. because they both end up as slaves, because the master has constructed this reality around themselves that is dependent on the slave, and that reality must be protected at all costs, or else the master will die. Mm-hmm. So the slave is threatened to serve the master on pain of death, but the master has to also work on pain of death, their own mental construct of their own psychological death, unless they continue on with mm-hmm. the illusion. So the idea would be to abolish power. Which, I mean, you say that and people are like, that's insane, go smoke some weed or something. But, you know, in fact, if you look at the dialectic, that is what is in our best interest.
Yeah, see, and I come down on this because of Italian philosophers that basically explain that it is the system of domination, and I can't recite exactly which ones at this moment, but there are more modern philosophers you know, that came out of Rome and Greece, by the way. You know, you don't just have to go to the ancients. And it is about this incentivizing domination that is part of every system that prevails. It doesn't matter if it collapses. When it's reborn again, there is an incentivization of dominance, right? And this is not necessarily part of the natural construct. It's just, it's a given continuation because it's what's offered over and over again. It you want to succeed, you're going to have to figure out a way to take advantage of others. That's the only way it works in modern history. And is that something that should be questioned? I think it should. Go ahead.
I think it should. I think it needs to be. Because question, you know, the sanity of our current course.
Mm-hmm.
No? I mean, what do we have to lose at this point? We're facing, you know, so many scenarios where, you know, there's not a lot of optimism in the world. If you go back 50 years ago at the, you know, scientific expos, or, you know, even like the Kennedy administration was optimistic. They sent a man to the moon. They believed that the trajectory was infinite, you know, and society believed it too. And since then, there's been a turn. I mean, I think it's likely if you poll people, you know, you would see that I don't think that the people are optimistic. I think that people are just basically like, how can we not enter into an apocalyptic scenario in the next couple of decades?
Right.
You know? So, you know, really, to me, I'm like, okay, that is the case. Let's face it. I do agree with you that we're not going to find, you know, solace in, you know, some insider elite like Trump to, you know, I don't agree with that at all. Obviously, you know, well, not obviously. I mean, it was a widely held view. I also don't believe that, you know, this idea anymore. I used to believe that, you know, we could change the system, you know, from a place of radicality, you know. And I tried, I think I mentioned in Aaron's show, where, you know, Ron Paul and Tulsi Gabbard and, you know, Bernie Sanders and others, you know, that I have a lot of people that I kind of tried to, from the margins, you know, Dennis Kucinich, and from the left and from the right, you know, I name names from both. But I've come to realize too that the system itself, it absorbs all of the energy directed. It's like martial arts. If you charge straight at your enemy, it will absorb it. And the way I can describe that best is how rap and hip hop got absorbed into selling Sprite.
Right.
You know? So I mean, and the message just gets diluted, and it turns into, or in some cases, I think, like in Tulsi Gabbard's case or in Trump's case, I think, you know, I think they've figured out how to create a dialectic where there was none there. You know, I don't think that was the case. This is just me conjecturing, but I don't think that was the case with Ron Paul in the 80s. But then again, who knows? You know, I wasn't there.
Yeah, but see, these people are opportunists. They come along and they pick up already festering issues. And they ride something that already is there. Look, anybody who comes into power and prominence in power always, you know, with these very sort of, you know, what is the term I'm looking for here? The populist point of view, right? They always pick up on something that has been sitting there and already organically evolving one way or another. And they pick up on that and they work with it. And then they tell you, look, you want to change this? I mean, look, Mussolini said, along with a whole cadre of people everybody forgets about, when he created what they call Italy today, which was initially a handful of sovereign states, by the way, this is how we're going to make it so all of you people have a piece of this great thing that once was. And that is a template. There used to be something great. Let's do it again. Whether it's the Roman Empire or Make America Great Again, or let's make Germany straight again, you know, because we've been under the thumb of the bankers and everything else since World War I, it doesn't matter. You can hook into people who clearly feel as though they're being left out of something and say, you can be part of this again. And it doesn't matter if it actually makes any kind of sense. It just has to emotionally resonate with people that feel like they've been left out. You tell them they're no longer being left out. I mean, this is how, like, say, the Republican Party absorbed the libertarians quite well.
Totally. Tucker Carlson's whole model is you're in on the joke.
Right.
But that's not true. Like, you're in on a part of the joke.
Mm-hmm.
But then on another level, you're actually the subject of the joke.
Right. So let's go back to let's have you stop punching down and get out of politics.
Okay. Yeah, you're right. I don't want to denigrate people that like Tucker Carlson. I'm no smarter than anybody else.
No. Listen, I don't care. It's fine. I'm just saying, let's get out of that because politics has not provided a solution.
Yeah, that's my. Yeah, exactly.
Let's get into what could. And again, back to this idea that there may indeed be a place where we could come together again. I'm not saying I entirely subscribe to the concept of let us reason together. But how can we get back to something like that and maybe go further with it so that, you know, people could start to recognize this is the actual condition as opposed to what they're being directed to accept as the condition. And like you said, there are individuals that don't even realize they're being victimized by things that they think are on their side. I mean, it's just, it's the strangest land, I gotta say. And it seems to be twisting into more of a dysmorphia of reality as we go into, you know, and I know, now here we go, old man. But I mean, as we go more into the internet age and the social media age, the disconnect from reality is becoming more and more profound to me. And I don't know if that's just because I'm getting old or if that's really the case, but go ahead.
No, I agree. I mean, so one of the central themes of my book is that reality is the idea of reality, of not necessarily just whatever reality, but like objective reality, universal truth, mm-hmm. absolute knowledge is an illusion. Fundamental illusion. And the reason for that is, you know, we cannot know the truth in terms of whether or not something is objectively true. We cannot verify the world. We cannot verify truth because the truth is the universe. What's the verification of the universe? What's the objective verification of the universe? You know, that's an absurd question because you can't. So if you take it far enough, there's no one-to-one. There's no one equals one. It's all tautology. So right. if you take that as the starting point, that reality is appearances. You know, and I go through in the book, I go through a bunch of examples of, you know, virtual reality and other scenarios where you lose yourself. You've lost track of what is real. And I think on a micro level, you know, that happens to us every single day to varying degrees as we engage with technologies like the internet or other things. And, you know, I was just reading the other day, there was something like Cisco came out with, I work in the IT field, you know, for my job, and Cisco was like, instead of complaining about, you know, the fact that automation is going to take over, why not get prepared to, you know, work and be the, you know, master of the machine, you know. And I just laughed at that because it's like they're saying this as if it's an eventuality, as if the machine controls us already, you know. And this is Cisco, so the people who control the machine are saying that this is inevitable and that we can't control the machine.
Quick comment on that, if you don't mind. Cisco is if you have any capacity for fear, I understand if you're afraid of Cisco. Because they, you know,
let's go there because I literally work in IT.
Because, but those people, you know, I remember when they were talking about the Internet of Things, and that was what 10 years ago now, right? And it's real, so they seem to know the trajectory. I'm just saying, I'm not saying everybody at Cisco. I'm just saying
I subscribe to all, you know, all of their communication because they're usually dead on about where it's going. Yeah, completely.
I mean, even if you look at it and you kind of laugh, which, you know, I sort of did, and then I started looking into, okay, your appliances can communicate with each other and be on a Wi-Fi network even when you're unaware. I said, ooh, okay, this is real, and it sounds like the babblings of somebody that I would usually run into in a New York subway. But no, it's real. And it got more real. And now it's just a given. Yeah. So every time I see something like that from Cisco, it's like, yeah, just get ready because everything will be automated. I know they're not bullshitting, man. They're just not. I mean,
yeah. I mean, it's real. I mean, but the funny thing is that like I said, it's framed as, you know, we have no control of this. This is happening. This is like the force of nature, almost like a hurricane or something. When, you know, in fact, like that goes against the idea of like democracy, representation, self-government, you know, individual identity, free will. Like, there's so many things about our American narrative that this idea of automation just totally contradicts.
But see, isn't this not a contradiction? I got to ask you this, and I'm sorry again, but I mean, this goes again to the heart of what it is you're talking about. It's not a contradiction in my mind. You know why? Every system that is created eventually becomes perverse and overreaches its original intent. So, you talked about the idea of, don't worry, the wave of the future will be, your life will be easier because of the computer. Okay, yeah, true, but as that force multiplier begins to grow, the momentum of that system starts to do, guess what? The exact opposite. I mean, a lot of these, you know, people's republic of this and that, where it's supposed to be the representative of the people are really the power and everything else, eventually gets flipped on its head. Because the longer a system stands, it turns against its original intent. And I don't care if it's the CIA or the internet. This is where we're at.
Yeah,
this
Chuck,
is what
I
mankind
agree.
Generates, right?
So that's so true. And that, I think, is one of the main points that I'm trying to make, is that we are not more powerful than the world. The world is more powerful than us. And not only that, but the world has an agenda that's bigger than us. It's bigger than the CIA. Mm-hmm. It's bigger than any entity. And it turns itself via an ironic reversibility. You know, it tells us something. It's giving us something, you know. And that, I think, is a very powerful idea, because, you know, we fear, like you said, you fear Cisco. I do too. At the same time, you know, I don't, in a way, because I've come to believe in this power of ironic reversibility.
Yeah, no, and let me clarify. So I'm not afraid of any of
that.
And
I agree, because I've listened to your show enough times. You're like one of the most courageous people that I've encountered.
Well, I don't know that I'm courageous, but I will tell you that, you know, I really have gone through enough experiences to say to myself, what is the worst that any of this can do to me? You gonna kill me? You know, this is not a terrible thing. I'm gonna leave this earth at some point anyway.
You're not afraid of death.
You
and
know,
that's Hegelian dialectic. You're not a slave.
That's the thing, is you can't hold it over me. I mean, you can hold torture over me, possibly. And I'm not saying that I wouldn't break under it, but I've also actually experienced some of that personally, and guess what? You do develop tolerances, and the worst things that can be done to me, forget it. I'm not concerned. So this world is going to go a certain way. Every system collapses, by the way. So nothing is perpetual. So eventually, everything goes away at the end of the day, and I know here we go with the nihilistic thing. So what does it all matter? Well, it does, because there
it
is,
because this force is a beautiful thing.
See, there you go. So it does matter, and even in defeat, an accomplishment can be had, and you can change the trajectory of things all the time. See, that's the other thing, though. Is this inevitability? Is also not true. Because, I mean, yes, indeed. Any system that becomes prominent does turn upon itself. And I do mean not just the computers and being an old man or anything, but even if you think about the concept of the use of oil on the planet, it gave great mobility. It spread, you know, like in the movie The Matrix, did you spread like a virus across the planet? Yes, we did. And oil did that, but now the backlash is starting to happen. And there always is. Any of these systems becomes an enemy of its intent eventually anyway, no matter what you do. And I'll tell you another thing, is when you come down to it, this experience, you know, what you can experience. I find this fascinating because there are a lot of people that are very hard line about that. And it's just like, what I can experience, that's, you know, my truth. You know, it hurts my head a little. But when you run the God question by them, it's very interesting. And nobody ever liked my answer on this, and I stand by it when it comes to it. And some things do boil down to the limitation of who you actually are. Here's a fact. Anybody who tells you they understand God is lying. Because if there is an omnipotent being that has no beginning, no end, is singular. You have no concept of that. You can't even wrap your mind around anything that is not finite. So what are you even talking about? You know, I figure that to prove the existence of, we could try and do it scientifically, and no, okay. Big, huge rabbit holes, and you can spend your whole life doing it if you like. But at the end of the day, even if you could discover with absolute certainty that there was a singular, omnipotent being, could you truly wrap your mind around it? Are you intellectually capable of it? You know, so there are limitations built in simply because you have a finite journey on this planet as an entity anyway. You know, so why not try and face the things that are going to affect you on a daily basis? I always try and boil that down too. And it's very weird because, again, then it's like, okay, let's get back to the objective truth. And what is that really? And can we actually share it together? Can we simply look at the same thing and declare it the same thing? I mean, colors are a fun thing when it comes to that. Just because you and I can look at the same thing and call it blue doesn't necessarily mean in my brain blue is the same thing as yours.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny that you mentioned colors too, because I mean, objectively, what is the perfect red? I mean, there's no answer to that question. You can say, oh, red is a spectrum of light of this to this, but what's the best red? What's the most red?
Mm-hmm.
Unanswerable question.
Well, but you may indeed have seen what you think is the perfect red. And it could be the way the toenails of the stripper were painted, you know, the first time you went to the club, right?
Yes. And it is, because you say the stripper, because the stripper is seductive. And that is another theme in my book, that seduction is more powerful than production. And that is not my idea. That is from Jean Baudrillard, a philosopher. But I believe it to be true, that the power of seduction is actually more powerful than the power of production, of value, of every human construct of, you know, of permanence. it just like melts away in the face of the power of seduction. So I agree with you that we can know what the perfect red is. It's the power. It's the perfect red is the color of that amazing stripper, you know, back when we were, you know, 23 years old, and man, she put on a great show, and I'll remember that.
You know what? That is a brilliant thing right there, and I gotta say, that is an amazing turnaround from where I was going, and absolutely apropos for what needs to be had here. Look, we're down to the last 8 minutes or so. And I want to give you a chance to sort of wrap this, you know, kind of put a bow on it, if you don't mind. This is a fascinating discussion. And quite honestly, I'm going to now reveal something to you. I did not think I was going to be motivated to want to read your book. Going through this interview, that's honest. I was thinking I'm not really going to want to read this, but it appears as though there is a great deal that could be learned here, and I hear some of the very interesting conclusions that I have come to being suggested here in this discussion. So I do actually find some familiarity, even though you and I come from slightly different perspectives, and as I said, a generational difference a little bit, but it's not even relevant here. I'm more than happy. I don't care if you're 10 years old. I've learned things from children, you know. It's great to hear somebody boil things down, even when, I don't know, did you stay for the Uncle Show when you were on with Aaron?
Yeah, I stayed. It was a blast.
See, you go into Uncle's world, and yeah. His world is definitely not my world, okay? But it is so cool sometimes to hear him boil something down and simplify something in his way where it's like, I can't argue with this man. You know, all the complex stuff that I go through sometimes and try go through the ins and outs of this and that and explain to you how this system runs against this system and what the reality is of the, of the government, of the different bureaucracies that exist and so on. It all becomes irrelevant when you just simplify and say, well, this is just stupid. And, you know, and you should be able to agree that this is just counterproductive. And that is, that's the brilliance of that show, which I've had people say to me, why do you even do that? I get the point of it. Some people don't. But
my aunt was like, it's just a bunch of people jiving about beer. I was like, no, it's not.
No, it's really not. It's actually a very clever piece of performance art and theater of the mind that I'm extremely proud to do with Aaron. And again, it's not the sophisticated truth-seeking, let's go through the documents. And there is a place for that. And I'm willing to do that. But sometimes you have to boil things down to their very basic elements and say, look, we can actually say that, like you said about this concept of what's the perfect red? Well, you and I might indeed have a very, very desirable idea of what red is. And again, to the seductive, right? You could think about, well, the perfect red I ever saw was, it's something I don't relate to, but I guarantee somebody will when I say it. The first time they saw a brand new sports car painted just that right color red. And that is seduction also, but that's in a different way. Or maybe it's not. But either way.
It's the same, right?
You and I can come to terms, though, and say there is a perfect red. It's not as though you and I have separate truths. They are the same. But it may register with us just a little differently. So that is the adventure of attempting to communicate with one another. And I find this 2 hours that I've just done with you to be a clinic in how two people can come from different perspectives, certainly have different sets of eyes, and still come to a conclusion together where there is exploration that we can do together. And who knows, maybe with any luck, improve our own ability to navigate this thing that is life for as long as it does continue on. So I think that is a hopeful thing, and I don't know if you get my entire point to this discussion tonight, but I don't mean you, Sam. I'm sure you're thinking about this and going, this was odd, but I sort of expected this from the cranky Italian guy. But but you got to admit, one thing I will do is do this my own way, and hopefully people can learn from it. And you've done obviously this work in your own way. You've read up on others who have done similar types of work so that you could get a template. You have a perspective. which is entirely valid for a lot of different reasons. Honestly, you've now inspired me to do what I didn't think I wanted to do before, which is read your book. Honestly, the idea passed the test in my mind, but now it was like, well, good idea, but does he actually execute? Sounds to me like you may have indeed done that. So again, tell people about where they can find your book. And go ahead and give your closing thoughts here in the next couple of minutes so I can shut up here and close out the show.
Well, thanks, Chuck. Yeah, I mean, I really appreciate you having me on. And honestly, I had a blast. Your approach is challenging for me, you know, but in a good way. I expected that and I wanted it. So you asked the hard questions, which is what I wanted. You know, I'm you know, tired of also, like, I can relate exactly what you said, where it's like, I would say you're a little more fearless than me, you know, but at the same time, I admire you for that. I'm trying to get to that place. I can say that. And, you know, I really, appreciate everything that you do on your show. I listen to it. I enjoy it. I enjoy, you know, the Achilles Network, everyone, Aaron, you know, everyone on that show, everyone on that network, I mean. So, you know, please keep doing that. And, you know, I'll keep on listening, I'll keep supporting. And I know I speak for others. So, I mean, that to me is the most important thing. The fact that we can have this conversation that is coming from different places, like you said, but at the same time, that's the best part. Because, you know, I learned some stuff. And also, I was inspired. So that's what it's all about to me. So yeah, I mean, and with that, I guess, yeah, people, buy my book. Chuck wants to read it, so that is the highest compliment for me. So please buy my book, DancingWithMyFate.com. You can buy it on Amazon, Lulu. It's hardcover, so, you know, it takes a little bit to ship, but old school sometimes isn't always bad. So,
no, fair enough. And look, in the future, there may indeed be an ebook, but I prefer the physical book anyway. So I do know it's available to order, and I certainly want a copy now. DancingWithMyFate.com, all one word, right?
DancingWithMyFate.com. That's right.
Exactly. And look, at the end of the day, aren't we all dancing with our own fate? Sam Idelet. Now, you're going to have to check the show notes for the spelling on that one, because it's one of those names that's kind of uncommon, I think, but definitely worthy of examination. And I appreciate your patience and tolerance for this 2 hours on the Ocelli Effect, man. Thank you.
I love you. Thanks, Ben.
Anyways, guys, no matter who you are, where you are, remember this. I am merely Ocelli. All of you are indeed the effect. Thank you, and good night.